welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. And I'm your host, Mike Allen. When we talk about that great march of Rochambeau, 700 miles from Rhode Island to Virginia, it kind of rolls off our tongue like no big deal, as if moving a 5,000-man army across muddy dirt wagon paths with deep ruts and across rivers with no bridges was no big deal. And no stores to order the tons of food and other provisions needed. Well, our guest this week, no stranger to Amazing Tales, will explain just how all of this actually happened. Dr. Robert Seelig is the chief consultant of the National Park Service for the Rochambeau Trail, and he is one of the world's foremost experts on the Revolutionary War overall. This week's trivia question, he was said to be the world's strongest man. Who was he? Stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. Yale New Haven Hospital was the very first hospital in Connecticut. They opened their doors 200 years ago and later introduced the entire country to the use of penicillin and chemotherapy. Today, some of the brightest minds in medicine choose to work there, and it's the primary teaching hospital for the prestigious Yale School of Medicine. For more information, log on to ynhhs.org. That's ynhhs.org. The Rochambeau Trail, a 680-mile path from Providence, Rhode Island to Yorktown, Virginia. It's the very path that the French commander Rochambeau marched along with his 5,000 troops, 450 officers, 250 support staff, 1,500 horses, 2,400 oxen, and 300 wagons. Now, have you ever stopped to think what that was like? I mean, really like. When they went those first 125 miles across our state, Connecticut, how did they cross the four largest rivers, only one of which had a bridge? How did they feed that many people and animals? How did they literally set up and take down camp each stop? How fast did they travel? How long was their marching column? How did they get their supplies? How did they stay clean? How was all of this arranged? Well, for these and other answers, we turn to the most knowledgeable authority on this trail in the world, Dr. Robert Seelig, Chief Consultant to the National Park Service for the Rochambeau Trail. Bob, I want to start off talking about the sheer magnitude of this effort. Now, we're talking about an army, and I think people just take this for granted. We talk about Rochambeau's army marching from Rhode Island to Virginia. First of all, that's 680 miles. And second of all, these are dirt cart paths, four rivers, only one of which had a bridge. And you had, 5,000 soldiers, about 700 other, officers and support staff. You had 4,000 animals, 300 wagon trains, all the supplies. Can you just try and characterize what a massive effort this was?
It is easier, I think, to understand the magnitude of having these thousands of people and animals crossing Connecticut when you look at the communities that they are marching through. They march from Plainfield, Canterbury, Scotland, all these communities. But then you look at contemporary accounts. Plainfield has maybe 30 houses, Canterbury 8 or 10 houses, Bolton 10 or 12 houses, fewer than 1,000 inhabitants, a couple hundred at most. And then over a span of 4 days, 4,000 people camp in the neighborhood. There must have been like a herd of locusts marching across Connecticut. Locusts that pay for whatever they need, they don't steal. But at a time when the speed of communication is the same as the speed of transportation, is the speed of how fast an ox can walk, the logistic behind this is in an enormous achievement.
Now, something that I think certainly helped me when you put this together for me in advance so I could kind of wrap my head around this, and I think it'll help the audience as well. It's not as if there was one column of 5,000 soldiers walking in a straight line. They actually broke up into four units, right, of about 1,200 each, roughly, give or take. And one went, then the next one went the next day, and so on and so forth. So like you're saying, over the course of 4 days, they might see 5,000 soldiers, but it didn't happen all at once, correct?
That is correct. There's logistical reasons. If you break your thousands of people down into four separate columns over four different days, then the communities and the campsites and the supply officers have a couple hours to restock before the next column arrives. The other reason is that if all of these soldiers with all of their wagons would march in one column, you would have a column that is 8 or 10 miles long. And given the speed of an ox of a mile and a half an hour at most, the top of the column would already be at the next campsite, while the end of the column hasn't even left yet.
Now, another key fact was that the locations for the campsites were picked out in advance and supplies were sent there ready for the arriving armies. But there were nine camp locations. I just want to quickly list these off. Plainfield, Windham, Bolton, East Hartford, Farmington, Southington, Middlebury, Newtown, and Ridgebury. Now, when you think about it, it only took, if I did my math right, 13 or 14 days from when they left on June 19th to when they got to Ridgebury July 1st, which is, again, remarkable in its own right. Maybe just spend a second giving us your thoughts on that.
When Washington and Rochambeau met at Wethersfield to lay out the plans for the campaign, they decided that New York City would be the target, and French forces and the Continental Army would meet in Westchester County. That means that French quartermasters had time to scout out the road, to do road reconnaissances, to pick campsites, to order supplies to be stationed there. That clearly speeds up the march across Connecticut. They get local guides. None of the French officers or soldiers had ever been in Connecticut or anywhere in the New World, really. And once you have time to prepare, mark, and identify the roads, that clearly speeds up the process. And at the forking of the road would be stuck a pole with a bunch of straw at top to show the road they were to take. There are no maps that they could hand out. There's no AAA.
Now let's focus for just a second on the animals. And we'll talk first about the horses. There were 1,500 horses that had to be procured from all over the place because there weren't just 1,500 horses standing around waiting to be used by the French army. But once those horses were procured, it became obvious that there was another issue, which was a language barrier, because horses in North America did not understand French.
By the summer of 1781, most of the officers learned some English, but the French didn't bring any horses, for example. So they had to purchase horses, acquire horses. Many of them, by the way, are driven up from Pennsylvania, because the main animal that is raised in Connecticut is actually cattle. So they bring up these horses, but as an American officer writes at some point to Washington, he has to hire American cattle drivers because the horses will not understand commands, and that could lead to lots of confusion.
Now, the oxen, 2,400 oxen, these are full-grown cattle.
Yes, as far as the oxen are concerned, yes, they are full-grown animals because they are pulling the supply wagons, and Rochambeau initially thought four oxen should be enough, but within a day or two said we better have six of them because the roads are in such bad shape that four oxen simply cannot pull the heavy wagons through those ruts that develop, because while these animals need to be fed, whatever goes in must come out again. You look at the amount of waste these animals produce along an 8 or 10 or 12 hour day. By the third or fourth day, the roads must have been one huge mess.
When you talk about 1,500 horses, and we're not even going to calculate the oxen in this figure, the 1,500 horses every single day produced 55,000 pounds of manure and 3,700 gallons of urine, which is about, give or take, about a third of one of those tanker trucks you see driving around with pool water in them. It's about a third each day. And you figure this was 13 days across. Well, you can just imagine what it was like marching behind that.
I would prefer to march on the first day's column rather than the fourth. I can just imagine what a campsite must have looked like. Today, I think the health department in Connecticut would shut these marches down the very same day over health concerns.
When you talk about food, every soldier, and there were 5,000 of them, the rations that they were granted for 4 days, they would get a pound and a half of bread, they would get a pound of fresh meat, they would get, I think it was 2 ounces of bacon or lard, 8 ounces of corn, 1 ounce of rice. And when you start doing the math, as you have done, that means that over the course of the time that they were in Connecticut, those soldiers ate 400 cattle and ate corn that would have consumed 800 acres of land, which is about the size of Central Park in New York City. That's just phenomenal when you think about these kinds of numbers.
What you need to keep in mind is that yields were so much lower in the 18th century. The size of cattle was so much smaller than today. The march of these French forces across Connecticut in 1781, and don't forget, of course, they come back in 1782 again on the way to Boston, is really a statewide effort. This is not something that individual communities or even a city like Hartford could do, but these supplies come from dozens of miles away so that there's enough food, there's enough flour for all of these forces.
One of the disparities that just has to be discussed is that the French had all their gold and silver, and the locals were certainly happy, particularly the farmers, to sell their goods for true currency versus the inflated or worthless currency that was floating around Connecticut at the time. And yet, while the French were getting what they needed, the Continental Army was not, were they?
No, they were not. And that was one of the areas of friction between those two armies, even though that friction of any kind was suppressed in order to maintain this image of mutual cooperation, etc. But if you are a farmer in Connecticut, and here come Continental Army supply officers who offer you for your cattle, for your grain, for your firewood, what they have been offering to you for years, which is paper money, which becomes worthless by the day. And right behind them come Jeremiah Wadsworth purchasing agents who purchase for the French, and they are offering you gold and silver. The choice who you're going to sell to is very easy, and patriotism notwithstanding, as a rule, farmers in Connecticut, but not just in Connecticut, all the way down to Virginia, prefer to sell to the French, which leads to complaints that while the French forces are living very well, the Continental Army will be starving. And some cynics would say, well, the Continental Army is used to starving. They've been doing this for years, ever since the days of Valley Forge.
And not only are the army mouths having to be fed, but you point out very interestingly, it was the Navy as well.
Rochambeau's forces are brought over here on a French fleet, but there are as many sailors on these vessels that are in Newport Harbor as are Rochambeau's land forces. The fact that they're out there is not mentioned very frequently because we're all focusing on Rochambeau, we're focusing on Washington, we're focusing on the Yorktown campaign. The fact that these soldiers and sailors also have to be fed, they need firewood, they need water, is very often just ignored because they have separate accounts of what they spend, what they purchase, even though Jeremiah Wadsworth is also the supplier.
Now, when you talk about moving from food to beverage, there was, of course, water that could be drunk, but at the same time, a lot of people were very concerned about the quality of water. So you tell an interesting story about how that was dealt with initially, and then Rochambeau had to make a swap away from the material that would be put in the water. Could you explain that?
Well, the water tends to be contaminated with bacteria and other little critters that need to be killed. And you can do this by putting alcohol, whiskey, or rum in there. And that's how Rochambeau started out, by apportioning a certain amount of whiskey to every soldier to be poured into their water. Soldiers being what they are, they prefer to drink their whiskey and their hard liquor straight, and then the water afterwards, which defeated the purpose. And so Rochambeau switched from alcohol, from hard liquor, to vinegar. Once you put it into water, it will kill bacteria, etc. The health benefits were there. I don't know if it made the soldiers any happier, but there you have it.
Now, the French, being French, love a particular delicacy that it turns out they found in Windham and Ridgefield. Could you talk about that?
The delicacy that you are referring to is, of course, frogs. And frogs in certain parts of Connecticut are very well known, and that's in Windham. If you ever go to Windham, you'll see frogs on the four ends of the bridge that goes across the river there. And the local lore has it, certainly, that when French soldiers camp in Windham, that, and I quote, they hunted for frogs as soon as they had pitched their tents. And according to the stories we heard, it would seem as if the army lived on little else. If you've ever seen the frog pond, which is still there, there's no way they could have found enough frogs for the whole army. But there's another story down in Ridgefield, behind the tannery of Mr. Whitney. There are springs and pond that were cleared, and a large quantity of frogs were found and were eaten.
Another interesting aspect of this march was the actual hours of the day that they were marching, and this was to avoid the worst heat of the day. Their day would start at about 2 o'clock in the morning. Could you walk us through what that looked like?
Well, at 2 in the morning, it probably was still dark. So as far as what it looks like, you wouldn't see very much. You need to take down your tents. You need to get dressed. You need to get your animals ready. You got to have some breakfast. So that takes time, an hour and a half, you know, easily. All of this happens in the dark, which is great for historians and archaeologists, because if you tear a button off your uniform, or if you lose something in the mud and in the dark, you're not likely to find what you just lost, but historians and archaeologists will find it 200 years later. It starts to get light, and then you line up. And this is something that's easier said than done, because, you know, you get more than 1,000 men, you got 100, 150 wagons with you, you got some artillery with you. And as you line up, that column suddenly turns out to be a mile and a half long, which means that anybody says, well, the French forces started their march at 4 in the morning, that means that it is the troops at the very top that set out at 4 in the morning. But by the time the end actually starts marching too, it's more like, you know, 4:30. Think of something like when you're driving and your traffic lights goes from red to green, how long it takes before the last car in that column, the sixth, seventh, or eighth car, actually starts driving. And that's what happens with these marches too, which also means, of course, then the first elements of your column may be at their next campsite at noon or 1 in the afternoon, but it's going to be 2 or 2:30 before the whole regiment will have arrived at that campsite.
Waiting for them at the campsite are their supplies, and this is including food for the humans, food for the animals. Now, I just have to run through this list of what was waiting for them. You're talking about 20 tons of hay, 20 tons of straw, hundreds of bushels of oats and Indian corn. I mean, we're talking 200-300 bushels of each, 25 cattle, 12 sheep, 6 calves, and 25 cords of wood. So they arrive and they still have to process a lot of this stuff.
That is correct. I mean, the hay is for the animals. The straw is for the soldiers to sleep on in their tents. Oats and corn, again, for the horses and for the cattle. But yeah, the head of cattle that are there need to be slaughtered.
We have to talk about the 4 main rivers that the army had to cross. And only one of the 4 had a bridge. So would you explain, you know, how they did this?
There are 4 major rivers, the Quinebaugh near Canterbury, the Connecticut River in Hartford, the Naugatuck River and the Costa Housatonic near Southbury. Whenever possible, French forces and the Continental Army later on too would try and find a ford. Crossing the river via a ford is the fastest way of doing it. It's also the cheapest way because you don't have to pay for using a ford. Once you get to Hartford, the Connecticut River, we have a ferry that French forces use. They had to pay for it. That is clearly a bottleneck that you try to avoid because these ferries carry maybe 1 or 2 wagons, maybe 50 soldiers. So it takes forever. The only time where there's a bridge that French forces can use to cross, that's the bridge across the Housatonic River at Southbury. It's something the French had never seen, and there are drawings in various accounts and descriptions that all the timber work is supported without pillars. But that's the only bridge of any size that the French forces need to cross.
We have to talk about hygiene. Some people, I'm sure, are wondering just not only what was it like to try and dodge all of the animal waste along the way, but you also had 5,000 of your best friends that you're hiking along with who probably didn't smell great. What did they do for hygiene? How did they keep clean?
The hygienic concern of keeping clean, smelling good and all that, I think is very much a 21st century concern. No matter what they try on their marches, there's no time to do laundry, to wash your uniforms, to keep them clean. If you live around campfire every day, for those of you who have been camping, the smell of the campfire, of the smoke and all will stay with you. 7, 8, 9 people sleeping in a tent in their clothes, it's virtually impossible to keep clean. Bathing, swimming is discouraged. I have not come across any account that says that the soldiers took their clothes off and went swimming to clean themselves. What all of this leads to, of course, is that in all armies of pre-industrial Europe, the majority of people die of sickness, of diseases, rather than through combat. Again, if soldiers get up at 2:30 in the morning and it is dark, they step in, there's animal waste, it's very difficult.
Yes, the Connecticut campaign, 9 campsites in 13 days, was only the start. Rochambeau's troops met up with George Washington's Continental Forces in White Plains and then set out for the remaining 550 miles to Yorktown, Virginia, where they would team up to win the final and decisive battle for independence in the Revolutionary War. That wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. Now, you should really check out the Rochambeau Trail website, where you can read up on all of the sites in Connecticut and elsewhere. It's just full of interesting nuggets of information, maps, and explanations. It's w3r-us.org. That's w3r-us.org. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Dr. Robert Selig, Chief Consultant to the National Park Service for the Rochambeau Trail. Well, the answer to this week's trivia question, the question was, he was said to be the world's strongest man. Who was he? Well, his name was Elmer Bitgood, a very large and very strong farmer from Voluntown, Connecticut. Next week on Amazing Tales CT, we're going to take a look at Elmer's life and the claims that were made in reputable newspapers about his Herculean strength. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.